From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. The story that dominated New England headlines this summer reached a dramatic finale just in time for Labor Day as Arthur T. Demoulas was reinstated as CEO of Market Basket. Demoulas spoke to workers yesterday at company headquarters in Massachusetts.
Thank you all so very, very much. You know, thank you. Thank you. Without you, and you're all so very, very special. And all I can say is it's great to be back together again.
While Market Basket captured headlines, it's also been a busy summer in politics, and not just with the midterm elections. Possible presidential contenders are already coming to the first-in-the-nation primary state. Texas Governor Rick Perry was full of praise for New Hampshire on his recent visit.
You have no state sales tax. You got us one up on that. You don't hear me say that very often, do you?
Meanwhile, as students from kindergarten through college go back to school, one New Hampshire university, Plymouth State, says it will no longer require applicants to submit standardized test results like the SAT.
The whole idea of using these test scores is that it puts everyone on an even playing field, but the data suggests otherwise. And, you know, we trust 4 years' worth of academic performance in a classroom over 4 hours on a Saturday morning.
It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange. Let's hear from you as we cover these and other stories. And we're going to start with Market Basket. So let's get your take on that story first. Call in 1-800-892-6477. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests for this week's Roundup are Jeff Feingold, editor of New Hampshire Business Review. Jeff, welcome back. Good to see you.
Good seeing you, Laura.
Also with us, Gary Reno, State House reporter for the Union Leader and New Hampshire Sunday News. Gary, thanks for your time.
You're welcome. Good to be here.
Also with us, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University and author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, thanks for your time. We appreciate it.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, gentlemen, let's start with Market Basket. And Jeff Feingold, you're our business reporter, so I want to start with you. Just remind us what happened this week and what's next.
Well, first of all, I want to say that I stopped there on the way home yesterday and stocked up on things I hadn't been buying for a few weeks. But it was interesting. I was in the store, and the smiles on the faces of the employees was really unbelievable, how happy people were. I bought some fish, and the woman, apparently it was the first time she had been able to sell it because they just came in, and she was like, I can't believe I'm wrapping fish again. She was
about
it.
Let me ask you a question, though, because fish is highly perishable, and that's been the issue.
The question
of how quickly they can get stuff from the supply chain into the stores.
Apparently, it's as fast as you can imagine. I've heard reports that, first of all, I guess I didn't answer your question, that after 40 days and 40 nights, there was finally a settlement between the two cousins, Arthur T. Demoulas and Arthur S. Demoulas, where RET, as he's known, is buying the full company for $1.5 billion with the help of a private equity fund and a commercial bank, which raises some other issues. But the stores, which have had no customers essentially for all this time, are stocking up as fast as possible. I've heard many reports that they expect to have 90% of their inventory in the stores by Monday, which is really pretty amazing. Which means that people will be working all weekend, through the weekend and everything. And they're very anxious to get back because the company's been just basically hemorrhaging money for all these weeks, as I'm sure almost everybody listening knows, because it's been pretty much the most important story, at least in this part of the world. It's really interesting that he did turn to a private equity firm and a commercial bank to get some of his money, because it raises issues about whether the company can keep the prices as low as it has and all those issues, because he's going to have to be paying. This company had no debt, which is really one of the sad things about this whole impasse between the two cousins, because the company was financially extremely healthy, particularly for a company in the grocery business.
Sure, and they were growing, building new stores all the time.
And they have $330 million in the bank, and it's not that way anymore. So it's interesting to see if their business model will remain the same or not. And they gave up some of their customers to competitors, obviously, over the last several weeks, and see how quickly the customers come back.
Yeah. What do you think about this whole thing, Gary, and how it Well, resolved, but now there are unresolved questions, as Jeff has laid out for us, both supply chain and also in terms of debt and prices and so forth.
Well, I've heard the company described as a development country, a company that actually sells groceries. But, you know, they have some significant holdings. And, I mean, that's what the solid foundation of the company, obviously, in the grocery business was the crown of the whole thing. But I mean, it's been an amazing story when you really think about it. I mean, in terms of the where in America today do you see management and the workers get together in one unified way to try to accomplish something? I mean, usually they're at each other's throats, and here we have a situation where people are working together and trying to save the company, truthfully.
Yeah. Actually, it really was. It's really one of the unique things in American economic history that I can't imagine anything like this. I've tried to find out that nothing like this in American history has ever happened in terms of the employees and the management together and the customers. You have to remember the customers played an important role in this because they stayed away.
Although some of them stayed away just because there was nothing to buy.
Yeah, no, absolutely. After a while, that's true. But that's one of the reasons that there wasn't, because they just weren't able to make any money. They couldn't keep afloat.
Dean, I'd love your thoughts,
sure.
And then we're going to go to our listeners.
Yeah, I mean, they're just as both Gary and Jeff were saying, there's a remarkable human dimension to this story. You could hear it in the voices of the employees returning to work, particularly the part-timers, who many were sort of caught without a safety net, essentially. It's a story of empowerment. You could just sort of see kind of the surprise and the satisfaction that they actually were able to stick this out until the end. You know, I assume a lot of the business will return given the nature of the story. I mean, you may get some people I've heard even say that they may shop at Market Basket on occasion just out of solidarity with what we've all just witnessed. You know, I thought it was interesting. This is a classic story of a kind of a family feud. Right before the deal was reached, there was some news that potentially they were going to shut down 61 of the 71 stores. And, you know, I thought, you know, talk about cutting off your nose to spite your face. You know, if you can't have it, no one's going to have it. But, you know, in the end, they cut this deal, this late night deal for Arthur T to purchase it. So, you know, who knows if this will happen again or whether it will be a model for other companies, you know, employer-employee relations, we'll see. But it's been a pretty remarkable several weeks.
Again, our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. In this segment of our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, we're talking about the Market Basket development this week. 1-800-892-6477. We'll take your thoughts on that story. You can email us at exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And gentlemen, here's an email from Mary who says, the thing about Market Basket is that the only people who get all these great benefits are full-time workers. She says there are very few full-time workers. Most of us are part-time. Back to work, Mary says. Do you call 2 4-hour shifts a week? Making a living. Mary, good to hear from you, from someone who works at Market Basket and is, you know, apparently struggling. Jeff Feingold, talk about the part-time workers and how they fared in this whole deal.
Yeah, the part-time workers, as we know in all the parts of our society, they don't fare very well. I mean, they don't qualify for benefits, for health benefits and all that other stuff.
Even at Market Basket.
Well, I, as far as I know, I'm not quite sure of the details of that, but I do know that it's not I think in terms of the way part-time workers are treated in Market Basket as opposed to other companies, I think it's still a much better situation. And I know a few part-time workers, and they were happy to be back. You know, it's really if you only get 8 hours a week, that's not a good thing. But, you know, unfortunately the nature of our economy today.
Yeah, we did a whole show yesterday on, you know, what this means for labor organizing, new models out there. People are now looking at this Market Basket as a way to perhaps substitute that type of organization for traditional labor unions, which are on the decline. That was an interesting show, and folks can tap into that yesterday if you didn't catch it. Jeff, go ahead and jump in.
I just want to say one thing. Gary mentioned that whole thing that it was a development company masquerading as a supermarket chain. Well, that's one of the interesting things about this is that with this new business partners with RDT, the company had made no bones about having the plans to expand to about 100 stores. It's 71 right now. Whether they can do that now is questionable, at least, you know, in the time frame that they had thought they were going to be able to do it. And the other thing I wanted to say about the people coming back, I've heard two different aspects about this that are interesting. One is that, you know, all these customers have gone to other supermarkets and now they might not come back right away because they thought, oh, they had a good experience at Hannaford or Shaw's or whatever. But I also have to say it's really just amazing the amount of publicity this supermarket chain has gotten about how the prices are great, the employees love everybody. You can't pay for that kind of advertising. It's every not even
people
just every day, but every hour. That
Market
people,
Basket now know all about
exactly.
it.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that it's going to be fun, you know, in terms of the customers coming back.
Let's take a call, gentlemen. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And from Manchester is Marlon. Hi, Marlon. Go ahead. You're on the exchange. Marion, go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Marion. Are you with us?
Hi. I'm Mary Ann Rogers. I'm calling from Manchester, New Hampshire, and I'm a customer, and I'm definitely coming back. I've been shopping at Market Basket for at least 7 years. I stayed away on principle because I felt that, you know, what the board was doing was so wrong. So I boycotted immediately, and I'll be going shopping tonight. Absolutely.
Even if there isn't, well, you wonder how much is going to be in there. Yeah.
You know what? Even if I just pick up a few things, I'm there to support the workers, to support the CEO. It is a family. I really support a family business model. That's why everyone's so passionate about Market Basket. It's a family-run business, and he runs it like a family. And I think people are just very turned off by corporate greed, and you don't – and. Other grocery chains can't offer that experience. There's a lot of energy and a lot of passion in the workers when you go there, and they treat you really well.
Okay. Well, Marion, thank you for calling in. We really appreciate it. And Dean, to you, very quickly, she's tapping into something that people have talked about nationally, that this whole thing kind of represents a mini backlash against an era of corporate greed, to use her words.
Yeah, no, that's true. And I think you could hear in her voice that the big story here in some respects is the relationship between the workers and the customers. But sure, I mean, this story really kind of struck a sour note with everyone when you start to hear the details about the, you know, dividend payouts, et cetera. Really nice human dimension here.
All right. Well, coming up, a controversial school choice tax credit program gets the okay from the New Hampshire Supreme Court. Sam Evans Brown has the story. He'll be with us. So keep it right here on NHPR. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. We turn now to a state Supreme Court decision yesterday regarding a school choice tax credit program, what critics called a voucher. NHPR education reporter Sam Evans Brown is with us. And Sam, just step back if you could for a moment. What is this program? How did it get started?
It's a program that started 2 years ago when sort of Republicans had full control of both House and Senate. They passed it over a gubernatorial veto, and it is widely seen by liberals anyway as a way to institute a voucher program without stumbling over the constitutional problem of the fact that if you have vouchers and parents are sending children to religious schools with them, private Catholic schools mostly, that could be unconstitutional under the state's constitution because we have a thing called a Blaine Amendment, which if anyone wants to look up, they can. But basically it's...
It basically says public money can't go to religious schools,
right? And so you put this step in between of businesses are going to donate to a scholarship organization, the scholarship organization gives to the parents, and then the businesses are given a tax credit. And so it puts a step in between. There's a little bit of distance, and there's this constitutional question of does that then constitute taxpayer money if it's just money that the government doesn't receive that it would have otherwise?
And then the question before the court was, is that a big enough or fat enough step?
Right, exactly. And the lower court, a superior court judge, had ruled that it was not. He said that it was indeed public money and that it couldn't be sent to religious schools. And so for a year or so, the program wasn't allowed to send any scholarships to religious schools. It was a problem. The program had trouble finding enough families that wanted to send students to non-religious schools. They were told that they were sort of administering the program incorrectly and that, there's some sort of back and forth as to who said what. But basically, they they have there are most of the families are trying to send their children to religious schools, and so it becomes a problem for actually spending all of these scholarship dollars. But anyways, the court ruled yesterday that the plaintiffs didn't have standing to bring the suit. So the Supreme Court didn't even get to the question of constitutionality. Basically, they sent it back to the lower court and said this should never have come before us.
Wow. So that was frustrating for all sides, right, Sam? And people wanted some clarity on this.
Yeah. Well, when you look at the statements coming from supporters of the tax credit program, they're basically just happy that the program will be allowed to continue the way it was designed. There were a few people who were concerned that the constitutional question was not settled. But then there's this real, you know, if the question of standing is you have to have someone who is actually harmed by the law in order to bring a lawsuit. And so there's this bigger question, which is how do you show harm from something like this? And they basically think that a school district, maybe if they lost enough students, might be able to show that they're harmed. But that will take years. That'll take the program getting big enough that a single school district loses a large number of students.
And as you reported, Sam, this program's pretty small.
Yeah, it's last year 103 scholarships given out. This year it'll be fewer because they've been having a hard time gathering donations because of the Supreme Court case.
Yeah, and Gary, you covered this too.
Yes, I did. The issue, as Sam said, The issue of the religious schools getting state money was not settled constitutionally. What was settled constitutionally in this decision was a law that was passed 2 years ago by the legislature, which basically either you could say it returned it to what it was before, or basically said that any taxpayer has standing to file a suit against some government action, law, whatever, if they think that there's harm. A court decision 2010 basically severely limited that, said that it really has to be real harm, which means it's essentially that something has to be in place, has to cause somebody harm after it's
directly.
Directly.
And instead of I'm a taxpayer and I don't like this.
Right. And so what happened was they said, no, this law, we told you once, this isn't the law. And you went and you passed the law anyway. And so we're telling you again, that's not the way it is. So we had set up again, once again, like we had in Claremont, this court versus legislature situation.
Wow.
And we'll see how that one gets resolved.
But. Yeah, Sam, final thoughts on this?
Basically, I think, this program is very small. There's this real question in my mind as to how much it can grow. I think it's become so politicized at this point that, basically any donation to it is going to be sort of a political act. And you know, when that's the case, they can get as much as $6 million in donations. Last year at their peak was $250,000 that they gathered. And so there's this real question in my mind is how big can it get given how politicized it's been?
Jeff Feingold, do you want to jump in?
Yeah, I think Sam raises an interesting point because even at the beginning of the program when it first was rolled out, before, you know, there was some controversy, but it, you know, no one ever realized there was a court decision this quickly. It hasn't really raised much money. It doesn't seem to be the kind of interest among businesses to take part in this. I'm sure there are several. You know, if you get $250,000, that's a lot of money. But I don't think it has the attractiveness that the supporters thought it would have.
Again, our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We're covering a lot of stories this week, from the market basket situation to what we're talking about right now, a recent Supreme Court case here in New Hampshire concerning tax credits to private schools. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477, email exchange at nhpr.org. Go ahead, Sam.
The other thing I was just going to say is that, other states in which that they have programs like this, a lot of them are fully utilized. You know, they're getting the tax credits all the way up to the cap that has been set.
Really?
Here in New Hampshire, I mean, obviously it's very new, but also I think one of the things that might stand in the way of a program like this is that we have, you know, according to NAEP scores, we have like the fourth or fifth best schools in the country. And so I think people are more satisfied with the public schools and there aren't so much clamoring for going to other schools.
Gary?
Well, I think one of the things, too, is the scholarship is going to be $2,500, which is the top scholarship you can get. I mean, that's not going to get you into Phillips Exeter or St. Paul. It's not even going to get you into Kimball Union, Proctor, or Holderness. So, I mean, it's not...
So it's a little bit of help, but not a lot.
Not a lot. And I think that's part of the problem.
Okay. Well, Sam, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Of course.
NHPR education reporter Sam Evans-Brown updating us on a Supreme Court case concerning education tax credits. Again, the number for you to join our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And gentlemen, I want to talk politics for a couple minutes anyway, because boy, there was a lot going on. And to you first, I think, Dean Spiliotis, the U.S. Senate race, the Republican primary, Scott Brown, Jim Rubens, Bob Smith. A lot happened this week.
Yeah, I mean, it is the case that we're only 10 days or so out from the primary, so you would expect voters to be paying more attention now. If candidates are going to run ads, they're going to do it right now because people are paying greater attention. So it certainly is heated up. We had this Senate debate on WGIR radio. You know, the overall dynamic of this race has not changed greatly over the past number of months. You know, you can hear sort of the continuing frustration by Jim Rubens and Bob Smith that kind of the conventional wisdom in the media narrative is that Scott Brown is going to be the nominee. You know, they've sort of the debate had the familiar dynamic of Smith and Rubens kind of going after Brown on gun control issues, climate change, Obamacare. Basically sort of trying to paint him as someone who's not taking clear positions. And it is true to some extent, I think, that Brown is kind of triangulating with one eye on the general election. So they're trying to pin him down. He's trying not to get pinned down. You know, all the polling data shows him way out in advance. And in fact, the Shaheen campaign running an ad against Brown. And typically when a campaign does that, you sort of already have a sense that that's who they're focused on as well.
Well, I have an email to that effect from Ray in Whitefield, Dean. Ray says, I'm interested in your comment and guests' comments on Senator Ayotte's endorsement of Scott Brown before the primary. Ray says, if I were Mr. Smith or Mr. Rubens, I would consider the endorsement disingenuous at best. Thanks for the comment, Ray. By the way, you can email us at exchange@nhpr.org. What do you think about that, Dean? Did Senator Ayotte go out in front a little too early?
No, I don't think so. I didn't find it particularly surprising. You know, we've also had Mitt Romney endorse Brown. We've had I'm drawing a blank here. John McCain was here campaigning with him as well. You know, there are two schools of thought in political science. One school of thought says primary voters are very ideologically focused. The other school of thought says they're very much focused on electability and who's the most viable candidate. I subscribe to the second school of thought. I think in the end, most people, if they're unhappy with some of the ideological positions, they hold their nose and they say, well, I want somebody. I'll take the person who's most likely to beat the incumbent from the other party. And, you know, all signs point to Scott Brown. So it's not surprising at all to me that the establishment is lining up behind Scott Brown. He can bring in a lot more money than the other fellows for campaign ads, et cetera. So no great surprise there. But again, I don't see anything in the kind of dynamic of this race that has really changed at all over the last 6 months. It's just other than the frustration level of Jim Rubens and Bob Smith.
Well, Ray, thanks for the email. Again, you can email us at exchange@nhpr.org or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Jeff Feingold, your thoughts, too, on all the dynamics of this U.S. Republican primary for U.S. Senate.
It's interesting. I just wanted to mention one other thing about Senator Ayotte. I do believe she also endorsed Frank Ginta in the first CD. Am I right, Dean? I believe that's true. You know, I thought so, but I just want to say that this whole thing with the dynamics that are going on, I get the sense that Jim Rubens and Bob Smith are frustrated with each other as well, because I think they both think they, if they were alone in the race, they could be doing a lot more damage.
They could be the Scott Brown alternative.
And you just get the sense that, you know, they know that they have to go after Scott Brown because, you know, he's obviously the front runner, as Dean said, by a wide margin. But there was some time a couple of months ago where they were both saying, you get out, I get out, you get out, no, you get out, that kind of stuff. But I think at this point it's very apparent that that's basically the only avenue at this point for either of them to make any kind of have any kind of effect, because it's just splitting up the vote against the vote that would be not of the people who just don't want to vote for Scott Brown. And there are a few of them. If you look at if you add up the numbers, you know, it's not a majority of Republican primary voters in the polls, but there are several people who aren't happy with him.
Two other races I wanted to ask you gentlemen about. And Gary Reno, in the governor's race this week, there were charges and countercharges and counter-countercharges about campaign finance reform or campaign finance rules, excuse me. What's going on, Gary?
Well, it seems like the last 2 weeks here we've done talking about nothing but campaign donations from one candidate or the other. Well, this week we had the Democrats going after Walt Havenstein and some of his campaign donations. They were saying that
he's a Republican primary contender.
Primary contender along with Andrew Hemingway. And they were saying that, you know, Havenstein started spending money on his campaign before he actually filed for the office, that he was taking money from PACs before that weren't registered in New Hampshire, and that his filing did not include a lot of information that needed to be there. They like the Republican Party, asked the Attorney General to investigate. The GOP has been asking several times for investigations about Governor Hassan's contributions. And so
she had to give one back a couple weeks ago, right?
She gave back $33 million.
Because it was, again, not filed on the right date.
And so about 2 hours after the Democrats filed this complaint, the GOP filed another complaint about Emily's List, which is a large national PAC that basically supports pro-choice women running for office. Well, it turns out that the Republican complaint actually – they were saying that they hadn't filed reports that they should have refiled with the Secretary of State's office. Those reports actually were filed. So they sort of backed out and said, well, maybe it wasn't quite on time what they gave the governor. And so finally the AG yesterday said, or the day before said, enough of this, basically. We're not taking up your complaint. There's nothing in here that says that there's any violation of any law. And Democrats, you back off too, because we're just – unless you've got some real evidence here – we're tired of it. We're not going to investigate these things.
Wow, that's really interesting. Almost sounds like a growth industry if you can become an expert on campaign finance filings and
absolutely.
When and how and who.
I'm not sure how much people care about these things, but that's what we've been fighting about here for the last 2 weeks.
Well, and interesting that the Attorney General had to kind of play the parent and say, enough, both of you, you know.
It is all inside baseball stuff, and you kind of wonder whether people really do care about this. I mean, I think, you know, maybe the activists do, but I really – it makes you wonder why they waste their time doing this kind of stuff.
Dean, do you want to jump in?
Yeah, this exactly. I was going in a similar place that Jeff just went to. You know, this kind of tactical campaign tit for tat is pretty standard stuff. It has, I think, in the grand scheme of things, it doesn't really have any impact. I don't think most people are paying any attention to it whatsoever. But campaigns get so caught up in looking for anything that can cause the other side to stumble that it just gets to be ridiculous after a while. And I think most people just tune it out.
Okay. Well, let's take another call if we could. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Join us on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup as we catch up on the big news stories of the week. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Michael's joining us from Concord. Hi, Michael. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Yeah, I wonder if people would comment on how important they think independent expenditures will be in the last closing days of these campaigns, because in the most of the primaries are Republican, virtually all of them, I think, and there's an insurgent set of candidates running against what they call the establishment. And I just wonder how much they think Americans for Prosperity and groups like that, what kind of a role they'll play.
Yeah, thank you, Michael, for the call. It's a good question. And Dean, there are some independent groups also supporting Dan Innes, Republican for First Congressional District.
Yeah, this is a fascinating topic. It's funny. Probably 15 years ago, I wrote an article with two colleagues up at Dartmouth in which we looked at independent expenditures. And at that time, they were really not having a much impact in the state. So the argument was that kind of the retail politics environment of the state and the campaign saturation by presidential candidates and their campaigns really didn't leave a lot of room for outside expenditures. That's no longer really the case due to a lot of the changes we've seen in campaign finance law. And the money has trickled down to sort of the congressional level and even the gubernatorial level. It's now the case that these outside expenditures far outstrip the money that campaigns themselves spend on ads. So, you know, to candidates who don't have a lot of visibility, who need some advertising presence on TV to soften up the other candidates, it can be a big help. You know, the problem with these ads, and we're seeing it again with this Shaheen ad that was pulled from the Boston station that was run by an outside group that said that, you know, she had become wealthy as a result of being a senator. You know, people see these ads and sometimes they just don't ring true. We had that famous ad against Maggie Hassan in the last cycle, yeah, about her living in a free house, and that blew up as well. So sometimes I find these outside expenditure ads kind of sort of have a false ring to them. So I think people have to be careful consumers. Plus, it's just also the case that when you get so many of them and you can't really tell who the groups are because the names are very vague, I think people just kind of get saturated and tune it out as well. But, you know, there's no doubt it can certainly have an impact. The other issue, the last thing I'll say is it's problematic for campaigns because they lose control of the message. They no longer really kind of get to set the discourse because these outside groups with enough money can take that message in any direction they want. So it's a potential help, but it's also very problematic.
So I mentioned Dan Innes, and to you, Jeff Feingold, in the Republican primary for the 1st Congressional District, between the former Congressman, yes, Frank Ginta and former UNH Business School Dean Dan Innes, Dan Innes won the union leaders in endorsement. Some people were surprised,
yeah,
by that.
I think that a lot of people were surprised about that because, it's pretty obvious to everybody that Mr. Innes is the more moderate candidate in the race. He's also openly gay, married. He's without a doubt he's not the typical union leader candidate if you go about the history of the union leader. But I think it also is a reflection of Manchester politics. I don't think there's any love lost between the newspaper and Congressman Ginta, former Congressman Ginta and former Mayor Ginta. I think that just is kind of a reflection of it.
How much do these endorsements help?
I think that's, you know, I know I'm in newspapers. Don't mean to insult Gary either, but I just don't think they mean much. I mean, you get to put it on an ad and say I've been endorsed by all these papers, but I don't think people make their decisions based on what newspaper is endorsing whoever it is. But it does shine some light on the dynamics going on within the Republican Party right now.
Well, and positive name recognition can't hurt anyway. All right. Well, coming up, if you loathe standardized tests, Plymouth State University says it will no longer require those SAT scores from its applicants. We'll find out more. Keep it right here on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. In a moment, we'll turn to a story out of Plymouth State University, which says it will no longer require students to submit standardized test scores like the SAT and the ACT. But first to you, Gary Reno, just in time for Labor Day, some people having that last summer trip. Gas prices are going down. How surprising is this?
Well, it's particularly surprising near a holiday. Obviously, that usually doesn't happen. They usually go up during a holiday. You can see it usually 4th of July. You start seeing them climb. But this year, it's very the dynamic's quite different because the prices are going down at this point. And usually, at this point, you see the prices start going up a little bit because you're getting into the transition between the production of gasoline and heating oil, home heating oil.
And, also, we've had lots of turmoil in the Middle East. Affects prices.
Right.
And, Gary, the legislature passed a gas tax increase.
I know. And people at the time were saying, oh, it's going to hurt the economy. It's going to hurt people. And those that support it said, no, it's a commodity. The price is going to be set differently. It's not going to matter what we put in for the gas tax. And obviously, the price has gone down. It hasn't gone up. So gasoline is a commodity, and it's supply and demand. And right now, there's a lot of gas being produced out there, and as the demand isn't quite that high, so the price is coming down.
And as you said, surprisingly, considering all the turmoil in the Middle East, the price of a barrel of crude, it keeps going down, or it's certainly not going up, which is really kind of surprising to me. I'm not an expert on oil prices, but I do say I took a trip last week to New York State and went from New Hampshire through Vermont and to New York, and we do have a pretty low gas prices here in New Hampshire.
Really? You saw a big difference?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. Again,
it's something to think about.
Well, again, the number here on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup as we get ready for our Labor Day weekends with low gas prices and all, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Jeff, as college students get ready to hit the books again, Plymouth State University says, hey, don't worry about submitting those SAT or ACT scores if you want to apply to our school. How come?
Well, there's been a long-running controversy over the last couple of decades, really, about the I don't know, the ability of these standardized tests to predict what a student can accomplish in college. It's Plymouth State is added to the list of, I believe it's in the hundreds now of colleges that either they don't require the SAT or the ACT, or it's not mandatory to submit the grades. And it's not just schools like Plymouth State or public colleges. It's a lot of private schools. I know, I believe Bowdoin is one of them that doesn't even require SATs, I believe. And schools, you know, of that colleges. It's something that's been going on for many years, that's why the SAT actually was redeveloped in recent years, because there's been a lot of criticism in academia about the accuracy, the veracity of these schools, what it really does predict, what kind of a student you'll be in college.
That's interesting, because the whole reason for the SAT, right, Jeff, is that, you know, it's hard to get an accurate read on how good a student is when, you know, high school A in New Hampshire and high school B in California could be completely different. So the SAT was supposed to be the great equalizer.
Yeah, exactly. But there have been longstanding criticisms of how well a student can take a test who doesn't come from the same, you know, standardized background. Like if you come from a poor family, or a family of color, or you're in the inner city or whatever, you don't necessarily take that test very well. It's not really designed for your kind of ability and knowledge. It's been a discussion that's been going on for many years. I don't think it's going to end. I think when Plymouth State does it like this, it does raise the issue again in New Hampshire. It's something that people have discussed, and I really do think that it should be a matter of discussion, especially how difficult it is and how expensive college is nowadays.
Well, one more question on this, Dean, and I'll turn to you. You know, Jeff used the word require, and that's right. These schools say we won't require it. But I've heard some people say, Dean, that while the colleges say students don't need these scores, that they're still welcome to submit them. So if it's my application, Dean, with the scores, and your application without the scores, do you look a little less dedicated, a little less serious next to me?
Yeah,
I
honestly don't know about that. You know, there is sort of an aspect of the admissions process, and I've been around it for over 20 years now, that is kind of a black box. You don't actually know what's going on inside. It's very sort of mysterious. I remember taking the SATs in the late 70s, and I would have loved it if the schools I applied to had not required it, because it was a pain in the neck to prep for. But I think just the reality is now that kind of the way in which students present themselves as applicants is very different than it was 20 or 30 years ago. It's multimedia. To some extent, it's been regularized across schools. They use a general online form now. I just think kind of the nature of the admissions process has evolved. And as Jeff said, there's been a lot of criticism of this idea that a single test can kind of predict or really level the playing field for everybody. And colleges use all kinds of criteria for acceptance. You know, it's a mysterious process. It's not always fair. I'm not surprised, though, to see these tests being less and less required by schools.
Jeff,
It's another thing that Dean kind of touched on there is that this whole idea between the economically advantaged and the economically disadvantaged is that there's a whole industry of SAT prep courses.
Right.
And that they cost hundreds of dollars, if not more, in some cases. And you know, if you come from a family that's well off enough to be able to afford this, you can learn how to take this test. And the idea that you can learn how to take the test should raise questions among people. That, you know, if you could pay someone to teach you how to do it,
and that learning costs
$100. How does that reflect your ability?
Sure. Again, the number here on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Gentlemen, I want to flip back for just a moment to politics and to you, Gary Reno. We're already seeing glimmers of presidential politics with a visit by Governor Rick Perry of Texas last weekend. What kind of themes did we hear from Governor Perry?
Well, I mean, he was back here, obviously. I think he was back here the day that he actually turned himself in for after being indicted in Texas, which for, you know, whether you you can play that either way if you happen to be Republican or Democrat. But he was back here saying, hey, give me another chance. I'm a new person. I was having back problems. I wasn't in the best of health 4 years ago when I was running.
When he had that little slip up during the debate.
And so he's saying, hey, I'm here and I'm really ready to run this time. And he's got a new image almost. He's got the glasses and a little more conservative look to him. And he made the rounds all over the state last weekend.
Yeah, he had a pretty big visit.
He had a very big visit. And from what I hear, he did pretty well and did a pretty good job of drawing people into the events he was at.
Yeah, and Dean, you interviewed Governor Perry, I think, on his last run, not this time around.
Right, in 2012. I spent about an hour with him doing an interview. Clearly, that was a tough race for him for a whole variety of reasons. I think he realizes that. He apparently has been spending a lot of time prepping with policy experts, kind of working on his image. He's both a little more conservative. He's got a little bit of the Johnny Cash thing going, too, with the all-black outfit that he had here this weekend. He's got his work cut out for him, particularly, you know, he's never been an easy fit for New Hampshire, although there is some libertarian commonality, just sort of culturally in terms of his political style. It's very Texas. And so he's got to kind of figure out how to be more of a national candidate. The last time he basically, you know, essentially just ran on his Texas record instead of kind of figuring out how to appeal as a national candidate. We're already seeing him. He followed up New Hampshire by going to Iowa, South Carolina. He's been very open about his ambition. You know, some people say that this indictment will do nothing but help him with Republicans who feel like this is a political vendetta. But we'll see how he does. He's got his work cut out for him. As I said, not a great campaign that first time around in 2012.
Yeah, and Jeff Feingold, just to wrap up politics, we had a question earlier as to whether Kelly Ayotte had endorsed Frank Ginter or not in that first congressional district race.
I actually made the mistake of reading a headline without remembering the whole story. What happened was that last year, last fall, Senator Ayotte attended a fundraiser for Frank Ginter, and she never really officially endorsed him, but she was seen at the thing, and some observers made the assumption that she was endorsing Ginter by attending his fundraiser, but apparently she's never done an official endorsement of him.
Okay. Well, and the endorsements will continue to come in as that September 9th primary gets closer. It's hard to believe it's less than 2 weeks away. So 2 weeks from now, we'll be talking about who won those primaries and what these matchups will be for November. Dean, I wanted to ask you for a quick update on a story out of Hudson. A federal court yesterday ruled in a case concerning the town of Hudson's panhandling law. This is something other cities and towns have been dealing with. Dean, what's the basic issue here?
Yeah, it is something that a number of cities and towns in New Hampshire and elsewhere have been dealing with. The issue here was we've seen it here in Concord with individuals standing with signs on street corners, and intersections, soliciting donations. And the individual in this particular case in Hudson, Jeffrey Pendleton, has been cited 18 times for soliciting without a solicitor's permit. New Hampshire ACLU has filed a suit on his behalf claiming harassment. This court agreement essentially says that while the case is being heard, the Hudson police will agree not to deal with panhandlers. You know, we've seen this in Concord as well. It's a safety issue in terms of people stepping into traffic. Concord had a real difficult time crafting an ordinance that would sort of allow people to exercise their First Amendment rights to stand wherever they want with signs, but potential for fines if certain transactions take place. The Hudson police is concerned that any ordinance will be essentially unenforceable. So this has just been a big headache for law enforcement. But for now, it's got to work its way through the courts before there's a resolution. And the ACLU has had some success challenging this issue in other cities as well.
One more business story that we did not get to when we were talking about Market Basket. And Jeff Feingold, to you first, but you also, Gary Reno. Fairpoint Communications workers have been they've authorized a strike. They're not on strike yet, but they're in pretty intense contract negotiations. This has been going on for a number of weeks. A very different type of labor action, a more traditional approach, what we're used to seeing, you know, two sides entrenched, a bargaining table and so forth. What's the latest on this, Jeff?
Apparently what's happened is, first of all, the union members have been working without a contract since August 2nd. They've been in negotiations. It's been very contentious. The relationship between the unions and Fairpoint has not been a happy one since the beginning when the Fairpoint took over the landlines from Verizon.
That was about a decade ago, right?
Yeah, it's been quite a while. And what's gone on now is that the unions and Fairpoint are just basically at loggerheads. It's so bad that Fairpoint says they're at an impasse, and the unions say, no, we're not at an impasse, which is a legal term because if they are at an impasse, Fairpoint can basically institute its the provisions of its final offer, which would be, I believe, level wages and much more contributions on the part of the Fairpoint workers, who apparently, from what I understand, pay they don't pay any kind of copay. I mean, anything towards their health benefits. Fairpoint has been itching to just restructure how its costs are being made, its labor costs are, for many years now. They've got a lot of competition because they're trying to become like basically a broadband company, and they're competing with Comcast. There was a big merger just the other day, another company coming in from New York that's making big inroads. It's a situation where basically we're watching what happens when a company just doesn't want to have a union anymore. It's basically what it is. The unions are basically fighting for their survival there.
Wow. Gary.
I mean, it's also a situation that we see just like newspapers where the industry is changing dramatically, whereas people just aren't using landlines anymore, and that's the mainstay of that company. And as people go to the cell phones and various other media, the company has no way of actually the foundation of the company that they depended for years and years on for their revenue is disappearing, and they're going to have to adjust, and how they adjust is obviously going to affect the workers in some way. Yeah. And it's just a real, real bitter drag down and out kind of fight over just what that will be.
Yeah, it's been real interesting to watch these two very different business stories of worker actions happening in Northern New England.
It really reflects actually what kind of relationship the management, the RDT management of Market Basket had with their employees, as opposed to the relationship that Fairpoint has with at least its unionized workers.
Well, speaking of workplace issues, next week on The Exchange, in honor of Labor Day, we have two shows on workplace issues, including on Monday, Dean Spiliotis, a special rebroadcast of your conversation with the author of a book, Cubed, which talks about the ubiquitous office cube and all the joys and strains of that setup. So we'll be talking about that as well. And then something we're really excited about next week. On Thursday, political junkie Ken Rudin of public radio fame comes into our studios for a terrific hour on politics. We'll get Ken's unique take on the 2014 midterm election. So definitely I encourage everybody to join us for that if you can on Thursday. That's what we're up to. How about you, Gary? What are you going to be following next week?
Well, obviously the politics are heating up tremendously in the state as we get toward the primary here, well, just over a week away. But in that respect, too, the second campaign finance reports are due with the Secretary of State on Wednesday, which will tell us how much these candidates have raised between the last report and this one. Viability as we come into the final phase here. We particularly want to look at the governor's race and see how well those candidates are doing, how the fundraising.
That's interesting. So each quarter they have to report, and on Wednesday we'll find out how well they did.
Actually, as you get to the campaign, the quarter reports are for the federal candidates.
I see.
The state candidates report much more frequently than that.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll look for that, Gary, for sure. How about you, Jeff?
We're looking at the really sexy issue of the Export-Import Bank, which is really actually a big it's a big political item right now. It's been
some people who want to get rid of that.
Yeah,
bank.
It's very controversial. There's a lot of people in Washington in particular who are upset about it. We're taking a look at, first of all, what it is and what the political landscape, how it's what kind of support or criticism it has among New Hampshire candidates, but also we'll be looking at, how has it helped New Hampshire businesses?
Heard it here first, folks, right? The Ex-Im Bank and its impact
Ex-Im
on New
Bank.
Hampshire.
Yeah, exactly. I know people have been waiting just with bated breath to read about it.
Well,
but actually, it is a very important thing because exports is a very, very important part of the New Hampshire economy.
Right. All right. Well, that's great. And Dean, how about you?
It's all politics for the next 10 days up to the primary. Next week, Tuesday through Friday evening, there is a major Republican debate for each of the major races on television. So there'll be lots to listen to over the next week.
Well, and we would be remiss, gentlemen, if we didn't congratulate a Nashua High School student, Deepika Kurup. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. She was awarded a President's Environmental Youth Award. So that's great for her. Congratulations to her. Just a little taste of what she did. This is from the Nashua Telegraph. Using a lightweight photocatalytic composite, she has found an innovative solution to harnessing solar energy for water purification, a technology she believes has the power to save millions of lives
throughout the world. So a big, big congrats to her. That's terrific. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. The producer is Faith Meixel. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.